All right, Christopher Lloyd, you've traveled different parts of the world, but early on in your life, you discovered with great interest the connections you see between humans and animals and the behavioral aspects and other aspects that a lot of us just don't think about very much or even realize. Do tell. This is in your new book, Humanimal. Explain in broad brushstrokes, please.
Well, I think it's intuitive for young people, particularly if they live with dogs or cats or hamsters, to think that, you know, that these animals are experiencing the same sort of feelings that they are. And for many, many years, whether from a religious perspective or from a scientific perspective, those ideas have been poo-pooed, you know, saying it's anthropomorphic and that there's no proof that animals are really like us, that we're special and we're intelligent and we can build cities and we can put a person on the moon and, you know, other animals can't do these things. But actually, a lot of the most recent scientific research is showing the links between us and other animals, that they feel grief and the same hormones are excreted in the feces of baboons when they're grieving as are humans. And that, you know, slime molds can solve puzzles by working out the quickest way through a maze. And that bees actually vote democratically on where to relocate their nest from one year to the next. And so as I started to discover these stories, I thought there must be a way of trying to present to younger people the link between us and other species, backed up by rigorous scientific research. So
sure.
I've worked with about 15 scientists. They're all listed in the back of the book.
Well, you'll certainly see examples where people believe that higher primates have human-type behavioral instincts, but I think they forget about the sophisticated mammals in the sea. And as you note, even the sophistication of certain insects.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, termites were building skyscrapers that make Manhattan look, you know, really meager. And they were doing this, you know, compared with the body size of a termite, you know, a 6 meter high, or I suppose in your language, a 12 foot high.
Yes.
A termite's nest is enormous construction, if you think about it. And there are millions of these little individuals living in there, all doing different things, building little channels for their air conditioning and building out chambers for the queen. And some of them are engineers fixing things and cultivating fungus so that they can feed off the fungus as a type of agricultural farming. So many things you would associate with urban living have been there for over 100 million years in the world of insects. So I think there's a tremendous amount we can not only learn from nature, but we can connect with nature when we start thinking of ourselves not as a separate species, but more as humanimal rather than human.
Do you fear in our busy world that we pay even less attention to animals and we're less likely to discover these ties? Or, as you say, very young people realize this and then they kind of drift away, and maybe something like your book is a way to reconnect.
Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, of course, living in a city surrounded by concrete and in air-conditioned houses and in hermetically sealed offices, we are creating barriers all the time. But these barriers aren't just physical barriers. They are also linguistic barriers. If we categorize everything in such a way that they are not human, they are another species, then we are automatically creating a mindset that creates division. Whereas actually, if you look at the science and you look at genes, you know, we're 98.5% the same as a chimpanzee. You know, 40% of our genes are the same as a banana, for heaven's sake, which is extraordinary. So I think the more we can look at scientific research and tell the stories as they are in a rigorously scientific way, but in an accessible way for young people, then I think the better the chances are we can create some nonfiction, which is how closely we are connected in an ecosystem rather than how different we are in terms of our behavior, because we're actually not that different.
And for people listening, talking to Christopher Lloyd, author of a fascinating book, Humanimal, Humanimal. You coined that word, didn't you, sir?
Well, I mean, I don't want to, I'm sure maybe sometimes people have the same ideas in different times and different places, but come up with them independently. And I certainly didn't copy the word from anybody else, but it felt to me after I'd written the book, when I was thinking what title, that this was appropriate to try and create a new construction that combines humans and animals, Humanimal, just as a way of saying, funnily enough, my favorite author was a man called George Orwell, who you may know, who wrote some famous books. He wrote a very famous essay called Politics in the English Language. And in that, he says, if you change the way we describe things and change the language, you can have as much impact on human behavior as anything else. So I think this is just a way, hopefully, of getting people to think differently, that you're Humanimal, I'm Humanimal, so is my dog and my cat, and so is an ant.
You ever come across someone who professes to love animals, maybe a dog or a cat or a pet, but nonetheless says the problem in your argument is, yeah, this animal group may have this human trait and this animal group may have this human trait, but only humans uniquely are able to do all the things that humans do, from fly to the moon to take a sub deep underneath the ocean to engage in genetic research?
Well, you're right, because, of course, I'm not saying that any one species is exactly the same as any other species. No, life only thrives through diversity, and without diversity, life would disappear very quickly indeed. You know, one virus could come and kill everything if we were all a monoculture. And so diversity is the insurance policy, so that if something changes, then some form of life will probably thrive as a result of that change. So the whole system depends on biodiversity. That means all species aren't exactly, you know, equivalent to each other.
Yes.
We're all different and special in our own ways, but we are all part of an interconnected system. And I think what's happened is that the tradition, in the religious tradition and to some extent the scientific tradition, has been to set humans apart from other creatures. Using the examples you may have given, no other species has been to the moon, no other species has created a nuclear bomb. That's great. But then, you know, humans can't see in the dark like a bat can. And, you know, humans, there are all kinds of things. You know, my dog, it can smell something 1,000 times better than I can.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many ways in which different species are superior to us that the arrogance of thinking because we've done some things that are different from other species means that we are the most sophisticated or the ultimate form of evolution is arrogant and dangerous.
Let's go over just a couple of the amazing facts. For example, you said initially how bees vote. Huh? Explain,
right,
please.
Well, I mean, it's hilarious in some ways and also rather piqued with sadness that we have over here on my side of the pond something called Brexit.
Oh,
I don't,
yes,
know whether you've been following it at all.
Absolutely.
But, we're trying to make a collective decision as about what to do with the sovereignty of our country. Bees have to make a collective decision every year as to where to locate their nest for the following year. And they use a brilliant form of democracy, which, if we'd used it for Brexit, would have solved our problem so much more effectively. What they do is they send various scouts out to various places that they think are the best place to relocate the nest. The scouts come back and they dance the waggle dance, which reveals the coordinates of the place that they think is best for,
yes,
for the colony to relocate. The other bees then go and scout out these various different places, come back to the beehive, and they dance alongside the bee that they think has the best place for them to relocate. And then the bee with the most followers after about 3 weeks is the one that wins, and that is where the bees then relocate. And it's a form of democracy called range voting. Now, if we'd done that in Brexit, we would have presented everybody with 10 different types of Brexit and asked them to choose which one they think is best, and then the majority probably would have chosen the best form of Brexit. Unfortunately, that's not what we did. If we'd listened to the bees and we'd taken this well-honed form of democracy that has evolved over hundreds of millions of years, then maybe we wouldn't have made such a mess of it.
Although, let me give you an analogy in the other direction. Bees vote, but occasionally bees colonies crash, sometimes not their fault. And, well, we look how Britain, to some observers, is crashing with Brexit.
Exactly. Well, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens. That's one thing we don't have a monopoly of, is knowing what's going to happen in the future. So we will wait to see. But I think that certainly observing nature is usually our best teacher and guide. That's my experience anyway. And certainly I've spent time with many scientists on this book, and they've all spent so many hours, months, weeks, and years observing nature that it's really fascinating to see how this all comes together into a kind of guide as to how so many problems that we wrestle with and grapple with have been faced by and solved by other species.
Talking to Christopher Lloyd, a great author of a book, Humanimal. He joins us from Kent, England, UK. One thing that apparently fascinates you and has long fascinated me are the various animals that show evidence of grieving.
Right. Yes, there are. And I mean, I've used three examples in the book. We have baboons, and we have whales, and we have elephants. And they've all definitely shown evidence that they grieve when their loved ones pass away. The elephants have kind of ceremonies where they stand around the bones of their dead. The whales can carry a dead calf and then be followed by a whole series of other whales in a kind of procession, which is a bit like a wake, really. And then the baboons have been found to secrete a hormone, a stress hormone called cortisol, in their feces or their poop.
Yes.
And particularly so when one of their close members of their family pass away, and then much more so than if another baboon passes away that isn't closely related to them, there isn't so much of this stress hormone, this cortisol, in their feces. So there is real evidence there, I think, that other animals are undergoing the sort of feelings that we're familiar with, and that, you know, if Shakespeare was writing his plays today, maybe he wouldn't just be playing out human nature on the stage, but human-animal nature on the stage, too.
I want to ask you in a moment how all this affects your personal outlook, but just one more example. Crows using cars to crack nuts? What's that?
Oh, isn't that extraordinary? I mean, some animals have shown such an ability to adapt, even when the environment around them is completely transformed. So these crows in Tokyo use traffic junctions to crack nuts, and they take a nut, like a walnut, and they place it on the ground in front of a car wheel when the traffic light is red. They fly away, wait for it to turn green. The car runs over the nut, of course, breaking the nut. Down come the crows, and they pick up and they eat the nut, and you know, they've used the cars as nutcrackers. And I mean, there's films of it. There's people have observed this behavior spreading from one junction to another, and it's an extraordinary example, isn't it, of how intelligence isn't just limited to human beings.
And the other wonderful thing of that example is a lot of us might think, well, this has been developed over millennia of evolutionary development. Here's an example with a modern learning curve over several generations. So that tells you something, you know. Well, I got to ask you, sir, given your obvious great respect and imagination for animals and some of the extraordinary things they do and some things comparable to humans, are you a vegetarian? Do you believe in hunting? Just how has this affected your life outlook?
Oh, that's really good question. I don't believe in hunting personally, so I don't go out with a gun, and I don't fish, and I would find personally ending any kind of animal life very difficult to do. I am not a vegetarian, because, at least not yet, although I could become a vegetarian, but I think it may happen as I consider more and more the damage that eating red meat particularly is doing to the environment. And the more aware I become of that, the less inclined I am to eat red meat, because I think we all need to think carefully about how we adapt our lifestyles to be able to make the world fit for purpose for future generations.
Well, like, for example, here in Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, we have a massive deer problem, and motorists crash into deer all the time. The deer dies or suffers a painful death, and obviously the car or SUV isn't left in very good shape. Many people, even those who oppose hunting generally, will make an exception for that because being shot and killed by a bullet can't be worse than what happens in front of a vehicle.
Right, and sure, and these animals will experience pain in just the same way, but I personally would not enjoy, and I get no fun or joy out of hunting for pleasure.
Yes.
But that's a personal thing, and I'm not saying that it's morally wrong. Sometimes nature is very, very harsh when it comes to population control, and it is not a moral system. It's a system of checks and balances.
Yeah.
What I am worried about is when things get out of balance, then nature can't insure itself against catastrophe in the future, because nature relies on diversity.
Yeah, author Christopher Lloyd with us from England with us, just for listeners joining us, and well, certainly species depletion of many different animals and plants for that matter is a great challenge for human civilization and what we may miss out on with a particular animal going extinct. But let me end with this. Some religious traditions almost pride the mastery of humankind over animals, and animals are completely there for our use. But then you go to the other extreme. I guess it would be the Jains in India, who, as you know, are extremely pacifistic, do not kill animals. Many are rigid vegans. Some even wear face masks to avoid inadvertently inhaling an insect or even a microbe.
That's true. And what that demonstrates, I think, is the beauty of diversity within humanity itself. You know, that we have different belief systems, we have different traditions, we have different cultures, and just like nature has different species, and we will thrive on that diversity. And if we all try and conform to exactly the same way of life, we become uniquely vulnerable and probably a threat to all living things.